Are you treating equally the concepts of happiness and life satisfaction? Because at the very beginning, mm-hmm. you introduced the concept of mm-hmm. happiness, mm-hmm. but yeah. then happiness yeah. almost disappeared. Yeah. Yeah. In your paper.
Yes, yes. Yes, that means in the questionnaire there were questions that were both questions. One question was how happy do you feel in your generally how happy do you feel in your life? And well, the answers there were just four point. Very happy, quite happy, not quite happy, not at all, not at all happy, and there was another question was this 10 points scale, how satisfied are you, or dissatisfied are you in your life, and well, the correlations was very strong, and because this life satisfaction measurement was more detailed, we for the correlation of, for this in statistical analysis we used only this question of on life satisfaction.
One more question, where the collecting of data ended?
Generally it was conducted on 2008, beginning 2009. So in some countries it was still before the crisis.
Yes.
And in Poland it was rather very and in most of the Eastern Europe the crisis wasn't visible as much yet. It already appeared in
But there were clouds
There were clouds, but in Poland it is
not raining still, yet, but clouds there were.
Altogether, well, those included in this analysis was over 54 or 56,000. But altogether it was more. But by the time we conducted this analysis, not all countries had already data cleaned and so on. It's unfortunately the collection of the data, though very costly, takes much less time than controlling whether the people were interviewed indeed, and whether so-called cleaning the data and creating the.
But how many people there were?
Excuse me?
How many investigated people were? 54,000.
Yes, 54,000 or 56,000.
Quite a lot. Uh-huh.
And all these were so-called representative samples. That means samples. There was the.
I have one question. In these days, as I notice in my professional field as a philosopher, there is a lot of worries about promoting personal autonomy, personal self-comprehension. And it means that we are taking care of this instead of taking care of promoting mutual confidence or mutual trust. Do you think this is a risk? Do you think there is a contradiction between one thing and another? I mean, if we promote excessively autonomy, we are promoting this process of individualization characterizing liquid modern times, but we are, by the other hand, letting out of our worries the what it means most important, which is the personal, I mean the trust, the social trust we have to promote.
Well, I think that there, of course, there are some tensions between this, certainly between promoting the personal autonomy, well, relying on one's own choices and well, which can go against caring of others, against responsibility of others. And well, but trust in people doesn't mean yet, well, caring for others. I think there was a question a few days ago whether a trust is... what is the value of trust in comparison with the value of solidarity? Well, the Protestant ethics included this famous saying, well, trust in God and keep your powders dry. It's, well, you should trust in people, but, well, take care of yourself first of all. But, well, once again, trust in people also is necessary. But I believe that also some feeling of control of on one's own life and, well, confidence in oneself is... doesn't mean that you always neglect others. Of course, involvement in others, solidarity with others, which means not only being sympathetic or sensitive to, but also involved in helping in. Working in doing something for others, it also needs this feeling of self-confidence and ability to act and making a choice to act on behalf of other people. So, as I said, there are tensions. There could be contradictions, but. There also is a possibility of combination of both characteristics, human characteristics.
Could I ask you to clarify your question a bit? I mean, when I heard your question, I thought, probably wrongly, you were talking about some of the pressures on you as a philosopher. In a university, that you're being asked to perhaps introduce things into the curriculum about, into the degree program about the skills you teach students? Is that right?
See, it doesn't have to do with a curriculum at the university, but it has to do with what some philosophers out of the university feels as they should be doing. No,
right.
It's something like is that movement appear in the 90s about a philosophical counseling, for example, philosophical practice. They think they should be promoting autonomy. But my question, as a professor Kenya state, was if we are doing or we should be doing this instead of not to understand it as a contradiction, I mean promote autonomy, but as a complementary or a tension. I mean promoting autonomy, but in that case promoting through the truth on other people. Anyway, curriculum, as you were asking for, when you are teaching at the university, the curriculum, I was teaching at the social work faculty, the curriculum at social work faculty is something that, and listen, this is very, very important, it doesn't promote the solidarity or trust on the other, even though that namely it is like this, but it promotes the judgment of an own social worker in front of the reality of a person he attends. And this is a process of individuation that have to do with my interpretation of the fact is better than your feelings and your questions. And I think it's a very dangerous thing.
Thank you. I asked about that because there are quite interesting debates going on at the moment in the UK in higher education curricula and curriculum developments, which relate to some of the points that Professor Bauman has been talking about. So, as you probably know, last October, the students who started degrees in England had to pay £9,000 a year in fees. So that's a three-year degree, £9,000 a year. You don't get grants, so you end up around about £50,000 in debt at the end of a three-year degree. One way universities have responded to that, or the official rhetoric of response, is that I'm a social theorist, as you've probably gathered. I'm a social theorist I'm a critical social theorist. I don't like the neoliberal world. Someone like me, I have been asked, how can I build employability skills into teaching about Marx, Durkheim, Weber, Zimmel, Bauman, Beck, Giddens, and people? Answer, not very easily, really. But the big push or the big agenda is to build employability skills into the agenda throughout degrees. And this means that intellectual content is now often being minimised and instead these employability skills are increasing. Now, there are two interesting things here. Firstly, the employability skills, due to the nature of universities, we have to develop curricula now for the next 4 or 5 years. Consequently, the employability skills that we might build in now, as Professor Bauman rightly points out, will be completely redundant, utterly pointless. Okay? So that's the first thing. But secondly, so these employability skills are structured around a neoliberal notion of the student. It's the student as individual consumer who has no solidarity with other students, who indeed distrusts their other students because the other student might be getting an advantage in relation to them. So the whole system builds distrust into it. Complete collapse of notions of solidarity, complete collapse of notions of satisfaction in learning. And why I was interested in your question is I was basically wanting, if any of you have got any ideas for us, we're trying to subvert this system, or some of us at my institution, just by making a realisation. So we are asked to build employability skills into the agenda, into the curriculum, but it's employability skills for students who will almost certainly never have employment of the nature that I've had. So it's employability skills for students who quite possibly will never ever be in stable employment. Now, as soon as you start thinking of it in that way, however, you end up with some very interesting possibilities. First, you can subvert the system, but you can build other skills in, like what we're trying to develop, associative learning. So employability skills talk all the time about critical reflection. So what we're trying to do is build critical reflection in by making students work with one another all the time. So dismantling the old assessment structures. So instead, everything is associative learning, where you have to develop trust. And so you don't develop, you know, the kind of outdated skills. Instead, through doing a degree, you learn skills which can then be used to build social trust, build social capital. Well, they are actually practices of social trust and social capital. And then feed outside of university life, we are hoping, into the development of social and political enterprises. You know, social enterprises, not in the sense of let's make profit. Social enterprises, let's work with a local community, let's set up a cafe for migrant communities so that they can learn learn English without realizing that they're learning English. So migrant communities can come to this cafe and they will be served by our students who only speak to them in English. That's the deal. And so they just, you know, so English then becomes the common language for the different communities. And so they develop their, you know, also development of social solidarity and trust. So that's why I picked up on your question. So I think actually what's happening in universities can be worked, it can almost be subverted. So Professor Bauman is exactly right. Universities lead to employability skills, which are by definition redundant and useless. But if we conceive of employability skills for students who will almost certainly never be in full-time employment, or quite possibly will never be in full-time employment, then we can work to a social agenda of building trust, building solidarity, and increasing life satisfaction, but not in the neoliberal way of consumerism. Yeah. So that's why I was interested in the question. It just triggered off those thoughts, which I confess are right.
I have to just notice that someone else wants to...
Because you raised this issue between relationship between trust and solidarity. Trust and solidarity is a very interesting point, really. I wanted to add a few words to it. Many years ago, I was invited to teach for one semester at Yale University in postgraduate school. And I was struck by two things. One, that students there in my group were very intelligent, very curious, very inquisitive, very pressing. And the second, that they were very full of hatred to each other. And just to give you an example, when someone was missing from a lecture, and from a seminar, and ask colleagues what they were talking about, what the old idiot talk about, and then normally he got the wrong answer, to look in different books than necessary. But the most striking case which I came across, when I recommend that an important, in my view, paper from a recent edition of some journal, what did happen very often, that the first person who borrowed that just cut out the paper from the journal and returned to the library without that. Now, not because they were poor people, on the contrary, they were stinking rich on the whole, but simply to prevent other students from doing just that. Atmosphere of mutual rivalry and competition. And that's what I wanted to add, that the impression of solidarity is created and destroyed by the setting in which you operate. Now, in so-called solid modernity, you can say quite a number of unpleasant things about it. I was one of them saying them, but there was one very positive distinction from contemporary liquid modern situation, namely the very setting in which people were put was a sort of a factory of solidarity. It was quite clear from the daily experience that by joining forces, by being faithful to each other, by being loyal, by marching leg to leg, you know, shoulder to shoulder, you can gain quite a lot. However, contemporary situation in labor market, in every company for which you work, is a situation of enforced competition and rivalry, because everybody is under threat of potential redundancy, of potential merger or something like that. Therefore, in your best interest is to plot against other members of the staff. And not only you know that it is your interest to plot against other members of staff, but you believe, and that's the question of trust, that others as well think exactly the same way. You don't suppose that they are loyal to you. You don't suppose that they are solidarity to you. So it is a question of social setting. It's a question of social setting, and my humble prediction is that the more liquid, the more flexible so-called labor market will stay, and so flexible and brittle our bonds, which unite us in the real life, the less there will be the inbuilt, inborn, endemic trust, and more endemic, inbuilt suspicion, and even potential enmity.
This is a question for both. According to the last analysis from Professor Kania, we can agree that actually we are in a more unsatisfied world, basically in the Western Europe, than maybe 20 years ago. Do you think this is because of the increasing of the individualization of life in the capitalist Europe? And second, for the Professor Baumann, don't you believe that what we need is to construct new common utopias more than to find individual utopias?
Excuse me, the last part I didn't...
For you?
Yes, well, that we... That we need what?
If we need to construct a new common utopia more than to find new or individual utopias, as Professor said, or maybe including to find new words or new notions, but with the same essentia, of the idea of and this dream of utopia, of the old utopia from the French Revolution, for example.
The first part of your question was that we are living in more satisfied. Well, this greater satisfaction with life and greater satisfaction in people did appear in this dynamic was visible during the last decade, mainly in the eastern part of Europe, where there were these processes of systemic transformation. And even if the living standards of some people didn't raise much, they were more satisfied, and well, particularly in Russia and Ukraine, people were more satisfied by the change of the political system. It gave them a lot more control or feeling of control, free press, more ability to move, to leave the country, to travel, and so on. And, well, in more detailed analysis, people emphasize that this ability to travel, to express greater freedom of speech and so on, is something important that makes them more satisfied with their life. And this was also a result of our analysis. So in a way, it showed that the organization of the society is important, can contribute, particularly where there is a visible change to this feeling of life satisfaction. In more stable democracy, despite of that, it usually that people for many decades before were much more satisfied with their life and more trusting other people than in the East. Well, this what happened during this last decade was exactly what Zygmunt Bauman said when he said that it increases with income and political change only to some point of satisfaction of the basic survival needs, and later this richer, stable democracies, this it went somewhat down. So, the answer is to your question, which, as I understand, is whether we do need only kind of, or we are able to construct only some kind of individual utopias. Individual, I don't know.
Privatized
utopia, or there is a need for social utopia. My answer is that though I think from observation, from research, I can predict that there will be rather trend toward this privatized utopia. My own values suggest that we do that we should look for the social utopia, although it's the public vision of social organization that could contribute to greater life satisfactions. Of course, we can go on into discussion whether it is possible. Well, I don't know it is possible to find such utopia. I don't have it anymore. That means I lived through greatest disappointment with the utopias were constructed during the earlier ages and centuries, and they didn't work. My disappointment with the collapse of failures of former utopias. At this moment, are on the I don't think that we shouldn't keep trying to find out some solutions, though I'm not very optimistic about how fast we can find any solution. And what more, I think that I don't believe that that we can find utopia or the vision of a good society which is good for everybody, for all conditions, and everywhere. So I think that this looking for social utopia is something that should be a common effort of people that believe that the old ways of social organizations are not working anymore. And well, that living in interregnum, we shouldn't give up for looking for the better society, but this effort should be common efforts efforts of the people in various parts of the world. That's what I...
Just a few words only to add to that. I agree with what Professor Kaja said completely. When she explained the relatively higher satisfaction of life in Eastern Central Europe, one only factor in your explanation was missing, and that is the factor of hope. The times in Eastern West, in Eastern, what in Western Europe was reality of life, you know, facts of life, there was the time of great expectation. Great expectation and great hope for the future. And I think that not the experience of daily life influenced their estimate of the quality of life, but the big volume of hope which was present in this daily life. Possibility of going abroad, finding interesting experience, but also interesting job, possibility going to the university, getting a diploma, many possibilities, prospects of life, and these are disappearing now, today. As I quoted from Le Monde, it is time not of rebellion, but resignation, which means losing hope. The hope is very important factor in deciding how people are evaluating the quality of their life. Not only how it is real in reality, but how it is hoped to be. If they have the strength to hope, okay. And the one extra element to good society. I agree completely with Professor Kaja. I don't have any blueprint for good society. When you write in every detail how good society should be like, normally what follows is authoritarian dictatorship. So one should be aware of that. Having singed my fingers with my unforgivably long life, I would say that the definition of good life, which I hope will command wide acceptance, wide agreement, is that good society is a society which thinks about itself that it is not good enough. That it is not good enough, but it is dissatisfied with itself. Cornelius Castoriadis, great Greek, French philosopher, pointed out that the trouble with our world is that it stopped criticizing itself. But criticizing itself in the sense precisely of losing this hope that it can be different. Margaret Thatcher, former Prime Minister in Britain, is famous to create the formula TINA, T-I-N-A. There is no alternative, which means that you can't do anything else. That is how things are. Whatever you do, you won't change it. All change could be only changes to the worse. So you should keep it, right? And that is the self-satisfaction in a sense, not of individual members of society, but of the ruling elite of the intellectuals don't have any alternatives to tell to people. When I was young, very seldom I heard the word intellectual alone. They were always a couple, intellectuals and the people. Intellectuals had some vocation, a mission to bring, you know, enlightenment, whatever, however you call it. Very seldom you hear about that. Intellectuals are a very self-referential group at the moment, not defined by relationship to anybody else around. All right, so a good society is a society which doesn't think that it's good enough, which questions itself, which fights injustices, which are profuse in every kind of society, and tries to improve them. Now, to finish it, you know, don't be optimists, don't be pessimists. Optimists are people who think that this society here and now is the best possible society. Better society is impossible. And this society is the best we can achieve. And the pessimists suspect that, who knows, perhaps optimists may be right. So whether you are an optimist, whether you are a pessimist, you are in the wrong position, really. But there is a third possibility. Humanity is not divided between optimists and pessimists. There are three categories of people: pessimists, optimists, and people with hope. So one needs to keep hope alive. Creating blueprints of good society and trying to force them upon reality, but to believe that another and a better society is possible and keep looking for it. That's it.
Just a question for Professor Baumann. Since you said that what's breaking down is the imaginary of the middle class.
Of what?
Of the middle class.
Middle class, yes. Middle class.
But apparently not the imaginary of the lower class and of the upper class. Wouldn't that breaking down be irrelevant? What role would that breaking down play in society if it's just a crisis of a sector, of a group of society?
What I was implying when I said that is that the social imaginary, which was dominant in old times, As I remember, that was called the dominant ideology. Now people prefer to speak about dominant imaginary, but it's pretty much a similar thing. So the dominant imaginary of society was imaginary of middle class. Why middle class? Because middle class is the only part of society which is, by its situation in society, made to believe in two things. First, that they must create their own position, they must be self-made men, so to speak. It's not a gift from heaven. And second, that they can do it if they try hard enough. Must and can. As far as the top elite, the aristocracy is concerned, they need do nothing really. They have already in very high position. When one is born a prince, one will die a prince. Nothing needs to be done to do something about it. As far as the lower class is concerned, it's not the question that they must do something to extricate themselves from the bottom, right? But the other thing, that they cannot do it. They must do it, but they cannot. And only middle class can and must at the same time. Therefore, the imaginary of society, which is typically middle class, is the imaginary. Study hard, work hard, and you will be awarded. Do not study, not study, not work hard enough, and you will fall down. You can go up or down. It all depends on you. Aristocracy cannot fall down. The lower class cannot go up because all odds are overwhelmingly against. There are no resources, there are no ways of defending oneself, no institutions protecting. Whatever you do, well, your only choice is, I repeat for the third time, resignation, the new phenomenon, right? Not only people who are not at work, neither at work nor at study, but people who stopped looking for one and another. Simply don't believe that that's achievable, it's attainable. They are falling in the state of resignation.
But since millions and millions of people belonging former to the middle class are now joining the lower classes, wouldn't that mean a change? Or I will ask it in a different way. Might we expect something, anything, from what's called the social movements? Might we expect that they can react precisely, but because they are not just composed by lower class people without instruction, etc., but also have been joined by middle class people? Yeah. Can something happen?
Well, that's a hypothesis. I suggest recently that instead of speaking as the class which is deprived and discriminated against and falling out of society, well, finding it difficult to keep their position in society, once this category of people was called proletariat. Now, I suggest the term precariat. Precariat taken from French, précarité, which means wobbliness, unstable, lack of stability, instability. You are walking through quicksands, you know, you don't know what will happen to you, where to put your leg next. Unstable, threatening situation. This precariat now is the name, that's another hypothesis, of majority, of growing majority of the population. It includes whatever was called once upon a time proletariat, and also a very big chunk of the middle classes. That's what unites us. And from the situation of precariat, I think two roads are leading. It can turn one way or the other. The one way is what I already said. Well, whatever I do wouldn't change anything. I am in a hopeless situation, I resign. You just stop, you are a plankton which the successive waste, tides, you know, carry. And the other is that the idea that the conclusion, what I have to do, is wrongly posited, because the whole problem is that what I am doing is irrelevant. That's the defining feature of proletariat. So perhaps we will change the question. And instead of asking what I have to do, because that's hopeless, ask the question what we ought to do. What we ought to do. So returning, in a sense, to the old-fashioned idea of thinking about good society, not good place in society, for me, but good society in general, and the old practices of solidarity action. Now, this is a very, very big problem. No time now to discuss it all. There are traps, of course, ambushes, all this way. It is not an easy way. But nevertheless, how to rebuild, start from rebuilding social situations which promote solidarity. Joint work, about the small at the beginning, mind you, small at the beginning, all majorities in history were born as minorities. There's no other way to become a majority. So the fact that this is small for the time being is not an argument against. But there are small niches where we can rebuild the context, social context, which supports the development of solidarity practices, not only solidarity feelings, but solidarity practices. Institutions of mutual help, just such a thing as changing our towns, leaving more places to the public, make public places in our cities not only more numerous, but also more attractive. People would like to stay there, not only because they protest against Prime Minister Erdogan, but because they like to be together and talk together and spend time together, and they expect nice things and pleasant things, satisfaction of life coming out of that being together, right? Out of this togetherness. Well, that's the other possibility. And mind you, it is only not on you, not on me, but on us together, that depends which way we will go.
Well, I think we arrived at the end of the seminar. I wish to thank again Professor Kenya and Professor Tester for being here with us and helping us thinking and reflecting on these things. But if you allow me, a very special thanks to Professor Zygmunt Bauman. That has been really a pleasure to have you here during the week. We will keep memory of that for a very, very long time, and I hope that we will be able to draw the right intellectual and moral conclusions of that. Thank you very much.
I don't know whether our presence was good or bad, but I am also for sure that it wouldn't happen without Professor Tarebaras. That was his idea, his initiative, his organization, and his very, very hard work.
Yeah, definitely.